folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. I have a special episode for you today. We're going to talk with Kadri Ishmael, who's joined us, and about the 1999 Ravens win streak. And a lot of people don't remember this, but it was really the beginning of the dynasty of the Ravens in a lot of ways. But Q, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. I appreciate that, too. I hope it's okay to call you Q, by the way. Something I should have asked you before the show started. Is that good?
That's great. I think most people who aren't familiar with my name, they want to put a U in there and call me Kadri. So it's like, okay, you really don't know. So Q gives them an opportunity just to shortchange it. And I've been called Q by a lot of my friends, so we're good. Q is fine by me.
So Kadri, as in closest to Kadri, the military term, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
All right.
Kadri. All right.
Very good. Okay. Well, let's talk about that 1999 season. And you came to the Ravens after a couple of years where you hadn't even had a single reception in Miami or New Orleans. Obviously, some injuries involved. But maybe talk a little bit about what happened in 97 and 98 before you came to the Ravens and then how you got involved with them.
Yeah. So basically, it was my wilderness experience. I call it my wilderness experience based upon some of the biblical studies that I had been doing. And I remember the one historian was saying the Israelites, when they got through the parting of the Red Sea, and now here, Moses and about, you know, a couple million people were sitting there and about to go into the promised land. It really was only a 15-day journey. But as the scouts came back and they looked at, you know, what was going before them, it was a daunting task and everyone doubted. So what turned out to be a awesome opportunity wound up being a 40-year journey, and they finally entered into their promised land. And so while I know for me, I would connect dots spiritually with myself, with my own life, I thought that I was kind of on this journey, if you will. I was, you know, in my comfort zone, my 4 years in Minnesota. I was the third receiver and a three wide receiver heavy offense. And I felt like, hey, I can, you know, just show up and play. And boy, was I wrong when I went to Miami and then obviously to New Orleans. And so both places, I had to really, you know, hone in on what it was to be a pro, what it was to really understand the nuance of professional football, both on and off the field. And I think because of that, when I got to Baltimore, it was a perfect opportunity for me to blossom.
All right. Outstanding. Now, obviously, reuniting with Coach Billick here in Baltimore, his first year also with the Ravens. How important was that in your decision?
Oh, it was everything. I think, Brian, I owe an awful lot to when it came to the resurgence of my career. He basically was coming in to a situation as the new head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. You know, Ted Marchibroda was, you know, given the boot. And I think, you know, Brian was tasked with putting together a team and, you know, guys that kind of knew his system. I knew his system really well. Chuck Evans was another guy who was with me in Minnesota, and he knew the system extremely well, as also Mike Flynn. There were a couple of different guys that, you know, we just knew what he was asking for. So I think it was a good fit for me to be in that position to join the team.
All right. Now, one of the things that I kind of want to talk about is that you never really played with that great quarterback in Baltimore. You had a chance. Dante Culpepper was your guy in Minnesota, right?
Technically in Minnesota, I did play with Hall of Famer in Warren Moon. I didn't play with Dante, and I were like kind of two ships in a night type of thing. So I was Minnesota, Warren Moon, then spent the year obviously with Dan Marino, didn't really do much in games, but Yeah, I could say I practiced with Dan and whatever that would amount to. But then I think in New Orleans, we had just a ragtag of guys who were at quarterback. So for me in Baltimore, especially that 99 season, it was absolutely interesting.
All right. So the 99 season, just to, for folks who don't remember it, and this is why we do these kind of episodes, Scott Mitchell started the year for two games at quarterback and bombed out. I think he actually got hurt in the second game, if I recall, but he didn't play well enough to maintain the job anyway. Then they went to preseason superstar Stoney Case, who was one of the worst quarterbacks in team history. And you, statistically, that's certainly the way it would look. He actually went 2-2 in his four games, amazingly, but he did not play well enough to keep the job either. And then they went to Tony Banks for the second half of the season. And Tony Banks and you kind of found a connection.
Yeah, we did. You know, I think early on, it really didn't matter whether or not I was playing with, you know, whomever at quarterback. I was just happy to play. And, you know, I say happy to play, not in a kind of just laissez-faire kind of a manner, but I was like determined to go out there and show what I can do, if you will. And so I remember Stoney Case in the Pittsburgh game, we had these routes called bang eights or skinny posts, and those routes were wide open like multiple times, and it annoyed the living, you know, beep out of me, because Scott missed me like three times that would have been easy touchdowns, like, I mean, just money. And I'm like, what the heck? So then Stoney gets in there, and Stoney's like, man, here we go. So he literally was just feeding me the ball. And I was like, all right, great. And actually, I got my first touchdown as a Baltimore Raven, you know, against the Pittsburgh Steelers. It was a skinny post. I remember just catching it and getting tackled. And I kind of looked up to see where I was at. And, you know, I could see where my body caught the plane in the end zone. And, yeah, so I had no problem whatsoever with, you know, Stoney Case being in there. But yeah, that game was an interesting game where we lost by three, but I felt like it was a game where we should have won had our quarterback play, you know, was better. So it's just one of those situations where, I don't know, like for us to just be treading water wasn't good enough. And I think Brian, coming from Minnesota, where, you know, you had Randall Cunningham, who was just lighting it up and playing extremely well, I think that's something that in his mind, he was like, change needs to happen and we need to play better at the quarterback position.
Well, if you look at the defense of that team, you can make the case the 99 defense was the best in Ravens history. It was in terms of yards per play against. It was certainly the year in which that defense really blossomed into what we knew it to be for the first, you know, for the last 25 years, essentially. But that defense had a number of stars on it already. The linebacking crew had all been drafted in 96 and 97. They had Michael McCrary, who was a pass rusher. They had Tony Siragusa in place. Sam Adams was not there yet, but Rob Burnett was still there. The secondary was largely in pace with Starks, McAllister, Herring, and Woodson all there. So the guys we know from that 2000 team, with the exception of Adams on defense, were all really in position to play. How disappointing was it to them that really the quarterback play in the early part of that season, I think, cost them a playoff spot, if you really want to be honest about it?
Well, I don't know if you would use the term them. I think you, as in you plural, as in you, the Ravens. I think it's easy for people to, and trust me, Ken, it's not you. It's everyone. People seem to like want to put the us against them mentality with this team. And what I think made the Ravens, my team in 99 and in 2000 so unique was that there really wasn't that us against them mindset. It really, truly wasn't. Guys just went out there and played. Like, you know, Rob Burnett, Larry Webster, Tony Siragusa, they were good dudes in the locker room. Michael McCrary, you know, he was so obsessed with sacking the quarterback and stats. It was, you know, kind of hilarious for me to see. You know, Cornell Brown, Ray Lewis, Jamie Sharper, those were the guys from a linebacker aspect of things that I felt, you know, wow, these guys are good dudes and, you know, they can play. I didn't really truly know Ray wasn't Ray yet. You know, he was getting there. But he was getting there. I think Jamie Sharper and Ray both worked well together. But just that whole group of dudes, you know, they were a good, strong group. And at the same time, a group that was kind of growing and blossoming into what would be obviously the historic 2000 team.
All right. So anyway, let's get back to midseason in 1999 now. So we've got Tony Banks now taking over. You really blossomed as a receiver again for the Ravens at that point. Not that you hadn't done anything for the first half, but you had at least three receptions in each of the last eight games. The connection with Banks seemed to be about as good as any quarterback you played with in Baltimore, though you certainly had three fine seasons here. You lost to Jacksonville twice in weeks 10 and 12. Maybe start with that, because that came immediately preceding that streak. And talk a little bit about the, you know, kind of the curse with the Jaguars. I know you were just part of it for those first two games before the Ravens started beating the pants off them, but how much of that was still lingering, and as a new player, do you really feel?
So I think what Jacksonville, what was it? Baltimore, Jacksonville, Pittsburgh, Tennessee. And we include, you know, Cleveland, but, you know, come on, let's be realistic. We're talking about. So from a bigger picture standpoint, with Cleveland kind of being the redheaded stepchild, I think for Tennessee and Jacksonville, they were like the two top dogs in our division. And I think Pittsburgh and Baltimore, we were kind of jockeying for position. All of us as, you know, a squad, as to a, there were rivals within each game. And I think for the way in which we played against Jacksonville, I believe Jacksonville, they had just some really good players like Jimmy Smith and Keenan McCardell and why am I losing my mind as far as their quarterback?
Mark Brunell.
Thank you. Mark and I came out the same draft class, I believe. And just from a bigger picture standpoint, like Mark was just primed and ready. I think he had some tutelage under Mike Holmgren and being under Brett Favre's understudy. So he was ready to take off. And I think the way in which, you know, the Jaguars, you know, just were coached, it was just like a perfect storm. They were awesome. But I think, again, you know, when you look back on those games, it really showed that, you know, we needed to play better. But also, if we were competitive, we were going to show up and play and be that team, I think, that everybody thought that we could be.
All right. So you come into the start of the streak. And of course, the first game is still, in my opinion, one of the most impressive wins in Ravens history. Playing the Tennessee Titans, the eventual AFC champions, lost the Super Bowl by a yard, famously, on Jones' tackle at the end of that game. And absolutely trashed them 41-14 at home. Still one of the most impressive wins I've ever been to. What do you still remember about that game?
Well, I remember, if I correct me if I'm wrong, I just want to be sure, but I believe Javon Curse, was he not on their team? Javon Curse was like the guy, as athletically stud anybody you can think of that fit the mold. That was Javon Curse. And I'll never forget. So we're playing and the play was called Orlando. So Orlando, the letter O was for out. Well, however you want to call it, Orlando, since there were two O's, it was double outs. So I'm lined up to the right side going into the tunnel at then PSI Net, now M&T Bank. But I'm lined up to our bench, next to our bench, and I do the quick out, catch the ball, literally sprinting upfield. As I am sprinting upfield, Javon Curse sprints up, tries to get in the way of the pass, does it. He sits there, counts probably one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi. He goes over to our bench, has a sip of Gatorade, and as I'm about to run down the field to score, literally I get pulled down from behind, which technically should have, could have, would have been a penalty. But unfortunately, they didn't have horse collars back then. And I get tackled and I'm like, who the heck? Well, it was Javon Curse. And that, I mean, you could say whatever you want to say, however you want to say it, it didn't matter. That was the biggest thing that stood out in my mind in that game. Like, that dude, like, truly was the freak. And he was just, he was unbelievable. Yes, I remember it well.
Remarkable first year. I actually don't know if this was the rookie that year, and I have to go back. Yeah, rookie in 99, and had 13.5 sacks right away. In fact, kind of a Hall of Fame career got a little bit derailed after three seasons. You know, you see, generally think that guy's probably going to go to the Hall of Fame, but played for a fairly number of years and was never the same player again after that. But anyway, there's a story about Randy White from the 1970s. It's very similar about him running down some receiver from, you know, the defensive backfield. All of a sudden, you know, I remember watching on TV as a kid, seeing this guy who said, Randy White's not supposed to be that fast running down, you know, the receiver. But anyway, it's a good one. You had 113 yards in that game against the Titans. What was the locker room like afterwards? Maybe tell me a little bit about that. Was there that extra feeling of elation winning a game that big against a team that good?
I think it just showed that what Brian was preaching, how we were working in practices, you know, all those little things, it was starting to take hold. You know, it wasn't like, you know, the Titans or Jacksonville for that matter. They were like, you know, dominating us. We had close games. You know, I think earlier in the season, it was like, what, 14-11 or something like that, with, you know, Jacksonville being 6-3. So Titans and Jags both knew that they were going to have these competitive games against us. And then, yeah, it can go either way, if you will. So, yeah, I think bigger picture wise, we felt like, all we needed to do is play our brand of football. And I think also give a credit to Brian, because Brian started realizing, you know, just the way things were unfolding with the offense, we needed to rely upon the defense, and that reliance upon the defense had to come from the head coach, recognizing that, yeah, he's a head coach that got hired because of his offensive prowess, yet at the same time, his offense isn't producing. But for him to make that critical shift to rely more on Marvin Lewis's defense, I think that really said an awful lot about Bryant.
All right. Yeah, it certainly was a change for him. I know he's talked often about the 2000 season and how difficult that was. So we get out of that Titans game. You know, it's a one-game winning streak, obviously, at this point, and the Ravens had a disappointing season so far, but this made the team 4-7. You go into Pittsburgh for the biggest game of your career, and in fact, the biggest game of any Ravens receiver still in history. There's only one that really compares to it, and that would be, I think, Marcus Robinson's game in 2003. But you had the 258-yard game, caught 6 of the 8 passes that Banks completed that day. Do you want to talk about any of those individual plays? I know Steve Shields, the safety, was involved in 2 of them, but who were you beating in that game?
You know, it's interesting because obviously going into that game, you know, you're coming off a huge win. It's on the road. How are you going to feel? You know, it's late in the year. It's December. It's still Three Rivers Stadium. And for me as a kid, you know, growing up, the Steelers were all that in the 70s. You know, the play and historic place was just like, wow, unbelievable. For me also, it was a warm day for December, which really helped me from a receiver standpoint. And while the Javon Curse tackle was in my mind, I also recognized that I really wasn't fully accepted as the go-to guy. I know that I still needed to gain the acceptance of my teammates. And so going into that game, I was like, man, I really want to play and play well. I pride myself on little things like, you know, I feel like in football, technically any sport, but the one who prepares themselves and the one who can recover the greatest and the fastest, apples to apples, talent to talent, that's the one that's going to win. Period. End of discussion. And so when I look at, you know, that game, I was feeling great. And then on top of that, the weather was amazing. And I was like, all right, let's go. Well, we start off, obviously, Steelers, you know, they do what they do. They jump out to a 7-0 lead. Priest Holmes, our running back, not a lot of people remember, but Priest was the guy. So he had a 64-yard jaunt down the sideline, and lo and behold, it's a 7-7 game. We kind of like go back and forth, but it was halftime, and I think the score was 10-10. And literally, Brian Billick was so pissed because our offense, in particular, our receiving core and just passing attack was non-existent in that first half. And when I tell you, like, from a bigger picture standpoint, the tongue lashing that he unleashed on everyone, and I was like, you know, I pride myself and coming in here, I'm supposed to be the go-to receiver. I feel like I'm coming off a really strong game against Tennessee. I want to validate, you know, what I am about in this game, and I need to play better. And I just want to start with a catch. And so we get back out after halftime, and literally from there, I think my first catch, I believe, was an end cut, and that end cut was 16-yard dig. I catch it, turn up field, got some good yards. But mentally, that kind of warmed things up with Tony Banks and I. So the first touchdown, I believe, was, started third quarter. It was a 54-yard pass. Well, that was a skinny post, the bang eight, that in the first Pittsburgh game should have been, could have been, would have been But literally, that skinny post, I snatched it out of the air, and I'm like, who was it? Shields, as you were saying. It was, I believe it was, let me go down and.
Who was the corner? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, the cornerback that I was.
Let me look for it here. All right, we can take a second here, but I'll find it for you. Tell you what, and we'll come back to it. So anyway, you had to beat that corner. What did you have to do to that corner in order to beat him?
Yeah. So basically, Dwayne Washington. Here's the thing about Dwayne. Dwayne and I were both in Minnesota together, and so we would easily do one on ones together, whatever. Dwayne was a first round pick. For the Minnesota Vikings, and Dwayne gets a fat contract. So basically, he and DeShay Townsend were the two guys that were like, the corners for that game. And literally, I felt like, this is my time. I know Dwayne thinks he knows me from Minnesota. He probably thinks he can hem me up. In other words, play me press coverage. And I was like, nah, I ain't having it. So literally, because of it being press coverage, the Bang 8 converted to a more of a skinny post that was more vertical than it was bending it into the goalposts. And I was on the same page with Tony Banks with regards to altering my route. And when he threw it to me, literally, I'm going up, I stretch up, make a beautiful snatch of the ball out of the air. And all I felt was just my entire right side, all the wind just get knocked out of my body, my whole ribs, everything was exposed. And that's where Shields was sitting there. And I guess he just like laid into me. And so in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I'm about to go down. Well, I also saw that, oh, wait a minute. There is this big old, like, nothing in front of me but a yellow end zone. I think I'm going to go ahead and run in there first. So it just, in one mental fell swoop, I just kept on going. I kept my balance. I kept on going. 54 yards later, I'm on the ground, like in pain. And so they get me up, they walk me over to the sideline, and I'm straight chilling. So that was my first one. And I just felt like, you know what? If we come back and do it again, you're not going to stop me. Well, sure enough, they scored again. So it was 17-17, Troy Edwards from, I think it was like Mike Tomczak. So now all of a sudden, okay, we get the ball back, another skinny post. And this time I was like, it's a good off coverage, kind of three deep look. And as I stuck my foot in the ground, the ball was just right there. And I mean, snatching the ball out of the air again. And the safety took a wrong angle, and I just felt really good as far as running it into the end zone.
Okay, so when you make your cut on that skinny post, how many yards from the line of scrimmage are you approximately when you make your cut, and then at what point do you catch the ball?
Yep, so technically a skinny post, you are a foot, literally one person's foot outside the bottom edge of the numbers. Going to the sideline. And then basically you stem from there. It's about five strides of your outside foot. You stick that fifth step. So my outside foot is back. About my fifth step, I stick my foot into the ground at around 11 and a half yards. And I am going to I'll be 2 yards outside the numbers from where I started. And then I am taking a very thin or skinny line towards the top part of the numbers, and I should receive the football around that 18-yard mark or 22-yard, around 18, 22 yards, and I should just get it right in stride. And it's like a skinny post. It's not a deep post. It's a nice, good, stick your foot in the ground off of that fifth outside step, and woo, no kind of defense.
It's very interesting to hear you talk about this. And this seems to me like one of the reasons why they do walkthroughs on Friday before a game is that you actually count your steps. You go at what, half speed or maybe even slower than that. You literally walk through the steps. So you know the dance steps to a route like that.
Yeah, I mean, and there's countless numbers of hours that you're in practice or training camp, doing the skinny post. So then obviously during the season, like I said, referencing back to the very first game, Scott Mitchell should have hit me in stride and he missed me.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious, high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
I would have scored. There are windows to where you need to hit the receiver, and he didn't trust the window to throw the football. So because of that, we didn't have that connection. Whereas for Stoney Case, you know, it was a situation where my first touchdown as a Raven was the skinny post, and literally right out of my break, I'm turning back and he's hitting me right in that window. And I mean, I'm catching it. And as I get tackled, I'm down. Well, I think it was like a 19-yard, touchdown. Well, that skinny post, you stick your foot in the ground at 12, you turn around that 18-yard mark, boom, I'm hitting it. And then I get in tackle right in the end zone for a score. So for this one, you know, we're out in midfield. And I'm turning around and I see it and I just snatch it out of the air. And, you know, that was a 59-yard touchdown.
All right. Let's come back to the third touchdown in that Steeler game. Talk a little bit about that one. Let me see if I remember. That was the 76-yard play. So this was your longest one. Might have been your longest catch as a Raven, I'm guessing.
I think I had a 77-yarder the year afterwards. But suffice it to say, I was a deep play threat. So the cool thing about the 76-yarder, I was sitting there and like, I'm, you know, blowing it up. I have over 100 and some odd yards. And I'm on my way to having a heck of a third quarter. Well, my coach looks over at me because I'm on the sideline. My ribs are still a little bit, hurting. And, we get the ball back and the one receiver was in there for me. And gosh, who was that? Who was my guy? He was my backup, but he was in there. And, you know, Matt Cavanaugh, my offensive coordinator, he looks over at me and it was a stutter go. So he looks over, Billy Davis was in there. And so sure enough, Matt looks over and he goes, Q, you all right? And I already heard the play. And I believe it was a third down call. I think, I'm pretty sure it was. But I was like, oh, this is a stutter go? And you're asking me. So it was 989 double takeoff. I was like, heck yeah. Okay. So literally, I'm running out there, Billy. Like, get out. Now, and this is interesting because in my wilderness experience, when I was going through the art of learning how to be a pro, there is no way I would have taken myself back in the game. I would have been content with, I had 2 touchdowns. You know, it's no big deal. I'm okay. But then I was like, no, this is, we got to play 4 quarters. We got to do this for my own self, for my teammates, all of that. And mentally, I was like, this is my time. Billy, get your ass out.
I got to get this straight. Because Billy Davis, very interesting cat, by the way, won a Super Bowl with Washington.
Cowboys,
describes himself as an all-around hustler, but I think he's worked with the Players Union in some capacity for after his playing days. I met him at the Dallas airport. I want to talk to you about this after we get off air here. He actually had his Super Bowl ring on me. To show me. I mean, it's like, obviously he was carrying it around, you know, to do that. It was interesting to do that. But Billy Davis in that Jacksonville game in 2000, he only had 3 catches the whole year, but 2 of them were big second and 10 conversions from Tony Banks on the touchdown drive that we think is the Shannon Sharp drive, but was equally the Billy Davis drive earlier there. But anyway, I want to get back to this last touchdown. So you put yourself in the game for Davis. Is that what happened? Meaning that the play was called and then you heard the play call, ran on the field, said, Billy, get out of here?
So Matt Cavanaugh is calling plays. And obviously during the week, you know, you're trying to look for different matchups and all the things. And so the skinny post was obviously something we put into the flow of the game. I'm having a great second half. So the third quarter, you know, I just totally went after Dwayne Washington. And so now here comes a critical, I believe, third down. And so Billy was in for me because of the hit that I sustained. I just needed like a break. And it was just running plays. Like we were trying to like ice the game, if you will. You know, they were good, but we were kind of like, all right, you know, if we ice a game, we're good. And, you know, so Billy basically was just kind of in there and doing his thing. But obviously you're paying attention. It's third down. My whole thing of what I learned in my wilderness experience was that everybody in the house knows that when it's third down, the go-to receiver is getting the ball. And it doesn't matter. I don't care if you telegramming it or what, you know, the go-to receiver is getting the ball. And so for me, I'm looking at Matt call a play and he kind of quickly looks over at me like, you know, what are you doing here? Like, are you good? And I'm like, heck yeah, I'm good. So he kind of like, well, get your butt in there. I'm like, Billy, get out. Like, I'm coming in. So he subbed me in. And, you know, they call the play. You could see where Tony kind of looked over at me. I was like, yeah, bro, we're about to do this. So Dwayne Washington was pressing me at the line of scrimmage. And I was like, oh, bro, I'm going to lull you to sleep. So I got off the line and technically I did like a half kind of stutter, like running a bad route. And I wanted him to know that, oh, I am about to break. If I break, that means you're a good enough professional football athlete to break too. And you can get an interception and you can be the hero. So go ahead and go for my fake. So sure enough, he stutters with me, but he trips up on his own feet. He falls down. I literally just take off and I look back and it's like, bam, right there. And probably one of the easiest touchdowns that I scored. So that was the last and final touchdown that was put up on that day.
Incredible receiving day for sure. Still one of the ones we remember as Baltimore fans. And Banks completed only 8 passes the whole day, and you caught 6 of them. So that was pretty incredible. 258 yards. Let's move on to the next game, if we can. We'll talk about the win over the Saints. Came back home for this one. Beat them 31-8. You had another 115 yards receiving. Anything about that game specifically you remember in terms of individual plays?
So from the Saints aspect of it, I remember getting a call from Chris Carter. And Chris Carter was the receiver, Hall of Famer for the Minnesota Vikings still. And, you know, obviously Chris prided himself on just being in the know of everything. And Chris, you know, I had this game of the ages, 258 yards. At that time, I believe it was me and 5 other athletes or receivers to have over 250 receiving yards on 6 catches, 6 or fewer catches. So it was like, you know, just amazing, you know, statistic. And then I think I was like top whatever in 250 plus receiving yards, and over 200 yards with 3 touchdowns over 50 in a game. So it was like awesome, you know, and I was named AFC Offensive Player of the Week. So, you know, I get this call from Chris. He was like, "Hey, man, congratulations. But you know, it don't mean anything if you don't do, you know, you don't have a repeat performance." And I was like, "Gee, Chris, way to ruin it." But at the same time, you know, there was some truth there. I was like, you know, I want to be the go-to receiver. I want to be the guy. And I remember they introduced us to the crowd at PSINet Stadium. And this is my big moment to kind of be introduced to the crowd. But at the same time, this is when I knew I was a part of the Ravens, because up until then, you know, Ray would, you know, talk to different guys and get them hyped and amped and all that. And, you know, he would come by and, you know, "Yo, let's have a great game," whatever, whatever. Nothing, you know, that wasn't motivating. It was just kind of like a generic thing. However, I'm sitting there after, you know, we go up against Steelers and beat them. And now it's like, man, Kadri, you did what you did. Literally, we're about to go out of the tunnel. They say, "Offensive players, starters, over here." So they're calling us up. I get in line and I am locked in and I am amped. I am like, "Yo, I'm about to do this." Sure enough, Ray comes up to me and I didn't see him, but out of the corner of my eye. And like, so I'm looking straight ahead, and all of a sudden he just turns and like faces me. And I'm like, "Whoa, this is Ray." He goes, "Hey, you go out there and do what you do." He takes off running down out of the tunnel. Defensive players run out of the tunnel. And for me, I've, you know, always was a hype man. Like, I just love the hype of things to get you mentally ready to be a, you know, that moment of being a gladiator for, you know, for that 60 minutes of football. And I was like, "Oh, Ray Kata gave me the blessing. I'm going to dominate this game." And I mean, you couldn't tell me nothing. I was like, "I'm going to go out there. I'm going to have a game." I was in my wilderness with the Saints. And so my wilderness experience, I was kind of ticked off, that the way the Saints didn't necessarily play me. And I really had, you know, I kind of had to sit back and act like everything was okay. When in reality, you know, I thought I was the better player. I think they had Andre Hastings and the other kid was Keith Poole. Those were the two wide receivers. Well, Keith was a rookie my year beforehand in the wilderness. And Andre and I came out the same draft class. And so both of those guys were the two starters. Well, here they come. Ray gives me the blessing. And in my mind, I'm like, there is nothing better than being so amped for this game. Sure enough, here we go. And there were some really good nuances to their blitz packages that they had. And we had, you know, again, the skinny post was going to be. So let me go ahead and back up. One of the plays, there was an eighth defender coming down in the box. If Tony Banks and I were on the same page, what's going to happen is he's going to, you know, have the line protect him, keep the back in, and now I don't have to break off my route. And I'll have the skinny post again. And this time, I was on the bottom edge of the numbers. But when that guy comes down, I move to the top of the numbers. It was like a little nuance. And so with that, I literally do the same route, but it's a little bit different. And I remember just snatching it out of the air. And like in my mind, I'm like, you just aren't going to stop me today. Mm-hmm. So the game is going on. And again, another skinny post. And I remember just sticking my foot in the ground off of my fifth step. And this time I was on the same sideline. So I stuck my foot in the ground. I came out of it. Boom. I catch the ball. And like, I'm like, not today. I mean, I split the safeties. And I mean, just.
I'm sorry. We lost about the last 5 seconds of what you said there, Cadre. You split the safeties and.
I split the safeties, and I was saying when I was going to the sideline after I scored, I mean, I was going so fast, and I remember going into the end zone scoring, and I go to the sideline. I remember Jermaine Lewis came up to me, goes, yo, Q, man, that was the fastest I've ever seen you run. And, like, the determination that I had, because I was like, I'm going to score. Like, I don't know about y'all, but, you know, this is my validation game. You know, Chris Carter, you challenged me, challenge accepted. One of the greatest to ever do it in Ray Lewis. Like, I'm a part of the Ravens now. Homeboy just, you know, he anointed me like, hey, do what you do. I'm getting emotional even thinking about all of it because later in the game when we had the game wrapped up, I mean, we're just, you know, whooping that ass. And I'm sitting there, and Keith Poole is on the sideline. He had a couple catches, but nothing, you know, really significant. Andre Hastings, I think he only had, like, you know, 3 receptions. And, you know, and like in my mind, I was like, yeah, mother effa, you only have 3 catches for 9 yards. I think Eddie Keith Peniston had 4 catches for 51. I was like, yeah, I was so determined. Matter of fact, I think he scored their only touchdown. But he looked over at me while we're on TV timeout. And he looks over, he points at me, and he goes like this, man. He goes, great job. He gave me a thumbs up. So he points over, gives me a thumbs up. And, you know, I was like, yeah, I appreciate it. And it was just like a validation because after the game, no, actually, it was either before the game or after the game. Their offensive coordinator comes over to me, and he was the worst offensive coordinator. They had the worst staff that 98 season and that 99 season. That was just a horrible coaching staff, worst ever. And I was like, you know, he tried to come up to me and act like, hey, how come they didn't want to resign you? I was like, bruh, the reason why they didn't want to resign me is because of you. and your terrible play calling, your terrible judgment of what I could have done. So like it just all just like I was like, yes. So not only did I have a coming out game where I blew it up, but I had a validation game where I just had a historic day at Pittsburgh. And then I had a game where it was like, yeah, you can't say shit to me. Freaking Ray Lewis was the one telling me, let's do this. And now Chris Carter's like, you want to follow it up? Well, then you better follow it up. And I followed it up. And I got the game ball for Pittsburgh, and I got the game ball for the Saints game, and felt great. Felt great. All right.
So I get a real sense from that description of how much it means to pro athletes to beat the team that didn't recognize what they, you know, who they were the year before. But that was a great description there. Let's move on to the Bengals game. And I kind of want you to focus on the defense a little bit here, because this is the first shutout in Ravens history, the first of many. And this game was very special. Obviously, they had four shutouts the next season. You mentioned Ray wasn't Ray. I do want to go back to the beginning of that Saints game, which you're talking about happened in the tunnel. That sounds very Ray to me. But you're saying Ray the player was not at the peak of his skills yet.
Oh, he was every bit of the you know guy that you know guys looked at and all that. He just wasn't what would be the 2000 team where. You know, that just, you know, that set him apart and put him on, you know, another stratosphere, you know, regarding the Super Bowl and all the things. And, you know, just being such a completely dominating football player. I mean, he was doing his thing. He was a motivator to us. But when your season is a 500 season, you know, nationally, you know, non-football purists aren't going to, you know, recognize who, you know, Ray Lewis is. Now, you know, you look at it and it's like mother of pearl, that 2000 season, but you have the wisdom to look at the 99 season and see what Ray was growing into.
All right. So coming out of that game, you're 7-7, still in the playoff hunt at this point, still have a chance. And boy, now it's not the time to think of it, but this is really a time where if you're a Ravens fan, you think about, man, if we hadn't started this year with Scott Mitchell and Stoney Case, this might have really worked out. We might be right there. But anyway, you're 7-7, didn't get eliminated by your own play. I think the Kansas City game or something was where you got eliminated, but I'm not 100% sure. You might remember, but you guys went to win that game against the Bengals to go 8-7. What can you remember about that day in terms of maybe watching the defense this time around and how they got it done that day?
So it was interesting because I think that's where from we have arrived, but here is the blueprint to winning. Run the football, be dominant in running the football, don't turn the football over, and allow our defense to do what it does. Matt Stover, he had a day. He had a day. You know, we had, I think it was Eric Redd who scored the first touchdown, but every time we, you know, got anywhere near close to scoring, here comes Matt Stover, and he was just money Matt. He was dominant. I think that was the first time where it was a day or a blueprint that was written and for, you know, Brian Billick, you know, to, for all of us really, but for Brian Billick in particular, he just knew, like, all right, our defense is kick ass. Why, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why, you know, worry about that. And I think, you know, they had like, you know, their offense, it was Jeff Blake. I remember he was always like a big deep ball threat kind of a guy. And they had some guys, Carl Pickens, Darnay Scott. They were, there were some really good receivers and all that, but as much as they were good, they just didn't know about our defense. And I think that was really the total domination that our team, you know, put on full display. Don't turn the football over, you know, let our special teams with Matt Stover do his thing and watch and see. And so, yeah, that kind of solidified things with Cincinnati.
And then you guys, tell me a little bit about after the game. Do you guys go back and watch the other games? Because I think, if I recall correctly, you guys were eliminated by the 4 o'clock games after playing at one. So were you in the clubhouse somewhere watching a game to try and see if you're still in it for week 16?
So I think what happened, my memory is a little bit skewed, but they have the record back then of the largest, well, we call them vision boards now, but the huge, you know, boards that showed all the play, and it went from sideline to sideline. Now it's like they're still, you know, just huge monstrosities, but they're not as large as, say, Jacksonville's or Dallas's or even the new stadium's SoFi. But back then, those were some huge, huge vision boards. And I think they put those games, the late games, up, I believe. But HD was not invented. We still had the little pixelated TVs in our locker room. And it probably, I don't know, it probably wasn't all that big of a deal. So we didn't necessarily get up on the know as quickly as you would in today's world of technology.
All right. Well, anyway, it was a great moment. I know after that 22-0 win, I was actually watching the 4 o'clock games. I was in Las Vegas at the time for whatever reason, missed a home game, which I would never do today. But it was a great moment to think, hey, they're still in this thing, which is cool. And then you went into that New England game in the final week. Bill Belichick, in some ways, the start of his dynasty was that 20-3 win over the Ravens in that day. Was that Pete Carroll was coaching them?
Pete Carroll.
Yeah. So anyway, lost that game to the Patriots at New England 20-3 in the finale to finish 8-8. But that streak still, to me, is the beginning of the dynasty, is that four-game streak. How do you think of it?
Yeah, I guess I didn't know in that term, you know, again, like what the defense was going to be. I didn't necessarily – I was thinking about, you know, if I can get, you know, what, two more catches, I'm going to get a six-figure incentive. I would reach my incentive bonus if I got 70 catches. So I needed two more. I wound up with 68. I was a little bit pissed at Tony Banks. I was like, bruh, but neither here nor there. I think the one thing that I look back on in the grand scheme of it all was that the camaraderie we had as a team was just second to none. We really, you know, blossomed and just played, you know, good team football. I didn't know it would amount to a Super Bowl, but there was this sense of optimism and this sense of like, man, this is fun and fun times. Let's do this. Let's you know, come back and do this again. And that was kind of like my mindset, you know, what I felt around, you know, being a Baltimore Raven.
All right. And obviously many years since, you've done Ravens broadcasts for many years, really loved when you were in the booth for preseason games. I thought you really brought something to the broadcast then that I've always really enjoyed. I like technical talk about football. They've had good people generally in the booth. I mean, Rod Woodson is very good at that. Lots of other people are, but I really appreciated that you were on those broadcasts for all those years. Tell people, you know, if they have questions about football or about the NFL, can they contact you on Twitter? Are you okay with that?
Yeah, 100%. I am Kadri Ismail. is my Twitter slash X handle, I guess, as they call it now. But yeah, I interact with fans pretty much on a regular during the football season on Twitter slash X. And man, I mean, when I say we chop it up, sometimes what I'm realizing in today's game, and I appreciate the compliment as far as, you know, just talking football on a broadcast from a preseason standpoint, when we would do the both radio and television broadcast, you know, my goal and objective was to be entertaining, but look at it from a fan's perspective. So, yes, I know football, of course, but I wanted to be like, you know, sitting there watching the game with a bunch of the fellas. When we got into the radio booth, it was allowing Jerry Sandusky to be the consummate professional that he was, and then allow, you know, my personality to kind of be out there as much as possible. And every now and then you would hear me, you know, not try to get in trouble with the FCC. So I'd be like, mother of pearl. And like, it literally was me holding back my tongue, but it became like a thing. But I really did. I enjoyed those experiences. And yes, from a television standpoint, just on WJZ every week for pregame talk and all that was and is going on what now. WJZ will be my going into my eighth season with them. And it's just been fun. It's been a great, awesome ride. The great Bruce Cunningham, he actually said in the booth before he retired, he was like, you know, Q, not many professional athletes really get a true second career in media that has spanned two decades. And I was like, holy wow, I didn't notice that, but I was really appreciative from, you know, days of BET, ESPN, all the way through into, you know, all the different TV shows that I, you know, took part of and hosted and co-hosted and radio and the different stations that I've worked at. It's been fun. And I love the interaction with both young and old fan bases.
All right. Outstanding. Kyder, just can't thank you enough for coming on. Is there anything else you want to talk about what you're doing outside of the broadcast game? You want to plug that quickly?
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's missile training is what I do. A playoff of my nickname, missile. But missile training, you can go to missiletraining.com. Don't forget the missile training.com. And basically, it doesn't matter the person. It doesn't matter what age. My oldest client is 85 and my youngest client is 6, and all ages, all ranges of athletes and male, female, doesn't matter. You can get great understanding of how to have better and proper and stronger movement. So go to MrTraining.com. You can reach out to me and we can have a dialogue.
All right. Outstanding, Kyder. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I won't go into more details about that, but the Recollection series, still looking to talk about some of your favorite older Ravens and what your big memories are of them, and in particular, anybody before 2000. Kyder, thanks again for coming on.
Appreciate you having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them.
Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.